it's one of the, if you look at the report by what is that now? Trying to find the one of the most common. Looking at the reparations board here. So with me today is Jennifer Notis with the Minnesota General Crime Victims Coalition, and she would like to provide some testimony on the bill.
Welcome, Ms. Notis, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Chairman and Committee. Thank you for inviting me here to speak today on Bill 425. As Representative Paymar has introduced, my name is Jennifer Notis, and I am the Executive Director for the Minnesota General Crime Victim Coalition. Just briefly, we are a statewide organization that assists local programs and crime victim advocates in the area of general crime. Motor vehicle theft is considered a general crime. To get us started today, I'd just like to paint a scenario for you that gives us an idea and puts a face really on what auto theft means to a victim. A 67-year-old woman lives in rural Minnesota with her daughter and two grandchildren. In the morning, she drives her daughter to work and her 8-year-old grandchild to school. On this particular day, after dropping off her daughter and grandchild, she proceeds with the youngest grandchild to the grocery store. She picks up a few things and proceeds to the parking lot to get into her vehicle. What she finds is that her car is gone. The young child is panicked and confused, and the grandmother's overwhelmed. She contacts police to make a report. She meets with a police officer in the parking lot while her groceries remain on the ground, melting. She calls her daughter, who's upset, but she's able to find a ride home. She calls the school, where an old friend agrees to drop off the oldest granddaughter on her way home. The groceries continue to lay on the ground, and the police officer then agrees to take her home after the report is complete. As soon as she gets home, she calls her insurance company. Due to her limited income, she had liability on her vehicle. She's now told that the insurance company will not assist her with the costs related to the motor vehicle theft. She's completely and utterly confused and completely and utterly overwhelmed. This is a very small town. There's no light rail in this town. There's no taxis in this town. There are no buses. Public transportation does not exist. The closest car rental service is over an hour away. Her daughter stays home from work for several days. Her granddaughter stays home from school. Several days later, she receives a phone call. Her car has been found in Minneapolis, more than several hours away. She's able to secure a ride from a friend in Minneapolis 3 days later. When she arrives, she finds out she'll need to pay the $138 towing fee plus $18 a day for the 3 days it took her to find transportation to Minneapolis. Completely frustrated, overwhelmed, angry, but without options, she pays the fee with a credit card because she doesn't have disposable income and doesn't have the cash. By the time she pays off the credit card, the $192 fee to retrieve her car becomes over $500. Now, is this scenario realistic? Absolutely. Victims of motor vehicle theft, having already dealt with the initial consequences of the loss of their vehicle, are shocked to find that the news of a recovered vehicle comes with a price tag. The good news is we found your car. The bad news is you have to pay to get it out of the impound lot. Motor vehicle theft is not simply an inconvenience for the victim. The victim suffers from increased transportation costs, whether it's from using alternative public transportation or from the use of a rental car. Often the result is increased travel time because the victim isn't familiar with working with public transportation or how the best way to get to work or to the grocery store or to the doctor, how to get there fast enough. The victim suffers the loss of wages related to the time needed to miss work to retrieve the vehicle or the time missed from work because they didn't have a car to get there. And there is often some credit card debt related to trying to pay the fees to get the car out. Not only does the victim suffer, but also the secondary victims. Those who rely on this individual for a ride to work or school suffer from work loss as well and often financial loss as a result. Those who rely on the victim for daycare services have to find alternative coverage when the victim is traveling to retrieve their vehicle. Those who rely on the victim for access to health care and doctor's appointments are left without. The Office for Justice Program maintains a crime victim justice unit who receives complaints for victims. A considerable portion of their complaints come from motor vehicle theft victims. One victim whose car was severely damaged by the thieves decided to leave their car in the impound lot because the value of the car was less, or they assumed, than the accrued impound fees. What were they told? But later they were told from the city that they could still get the accrued impound fees from their tax refund, and did so later that year. Another victim told the justice unit she couldn't afford to pay the impound fee and the loan on the car. Eventually, what the impound fee lot decided to do was to return her car to the car dealership. Still another victim, whose car was stolen by her friend's son and used in the commission of a crime, was required to pay the entire fee for the time the car was impounded, including the time the car was being examined for evidence. I do not doubt that the legislature takes auto theft seriously. In the past several years, bills have been passed to protect victims. There's now a law that indicates that law enforcement must contact the victim within 48 hours after recovering the vehicle to cut down on the time that the car is left in the impound lot. Also, there's a law that protects victims in the event that while their car is stolen, a traffic citation is issued, and if they show that they were not owners of vehicles during that time and present verification, then they must dismiss that charge. Also, the legislature has developed the auto theft prevention grant. Yet despite all of these changes and all of these funds that are directed towards auto theft, we find that 95% of victims of auto theft feel that they have received no additional assistance in the way of financial assistance or otherwise when they're the victim of an auto theft crime. I urge you to consider passing the proposed legislative changes so that victims can be appropriately reimbursed in a timely fashion in a situation they did not create, did not know, and would rather forget. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, let me, if I can just close with...
Representative Smith has a question.
No.
I just wanted to say that, Mr. Chair, that we heard this bill for about 45 minutes, and Representative Mullery's committee discussed all the policy implications. The only really fiscal matter that I guess the committee could consider at some point or when we actually vote on the omnibus bill is the originally the money was to come from the auto theft prevention fund, and as some members of this committee know, we have been taking money out of that fund and putting it into the general fund over the last several years. But there are, if you look at the fiscal note, there are unobligated grant funds that are left in that fund at this time. But I have talked to Bob Johnson, and he would prefer if we did that we take more money from the general fund and put it in the auto theft prevention fund and then take the money out. But I guess I'd need some clarification on this. So at this point, the bill states that the money would come from the general fund. The fiscal note came in much lower than I anticipated at $100,000. With that, I'd stand for questions.
Okay, Representative Paymar, would you like to move your bill at this time? There is now a quorum.
I would. I'd like to move House File 425 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay. Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I have a question for the witness, Ms. Notice. The bill requires that the proof of insurance be shown as the only hurdle, apparently, to get over, and that there is a cap of $300 on the amount of the grant to the individual. Ms. Notice, in your testimony, you discussed, you referred to costs related to motor vehicle theft, and you listed a number of them, towing charges, transportation costs, impound fee. You referred and described a case involving travel time, loss of wages, missing work, related credit card debts, that there were secondary expenses involved, daycare services. You referred to health appointments missed, dental appointments missed. It seems from that description that $300 is not enough. Why would you support a bill that caps recovery for all of those expenses at only $300?
Chairman and committee members, the nature of the bill is to cover simply the impound fees. I realize it's limiting in that capacity. My desire in kind of giving an overview today was to really explain to the committee that there are unrelated expenses that necessarily shouldn't be legislated in the nature that we're seeking to reimburse, but that victims of a motor vehicle theft suffer a great deal, and that this is just one way we can give back in a manner that we can legislate. We can't legislate being able to get that victim to their medical appointments or to their dental appointments. The loss of work, unfortunately, is just a consequence. The limiting nature of it is understandable considering the nature of the emergency fund and how it operates. There's always been caps on it in the way of how programs receive those funds. They're able to distribute them, but there's always been caps.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry.
Chair, Representative Smith, the other aspect of this that would reduce some of those additional costs would be this is an emergency fund, so someone gets their car stolen, fills out this form at the county, gets an emergency grant, gets their car out immediately, so some of those other lost wages and daycare and other expenses would decline if they could get their car out immediately.
Oh, Representative Smith. Mr. Chairman, just one follow-up question, and this may be more related to policy, but I wasn't at that hearing. If what this bill and what you're describing is, in effect, the policy whereby the state government, which is everyone that lives in the state, becomes the insurer for someone's loss in a motor vehicle theft, let me ask you this question. You want to cap it at the immediate impound fee or the immediate cost. Should the states, if we're going to create this liability and make the state the insurer against this loss, should the liability stop at that event, or should it at some point down the road grow to include all of the other related costs?
Chairman, committee, that's a very good question. Unfortunately, it's not on the table today. We're just dealing with the impound fees. I don't think it should stop there. I mean, we've got victims of crime who are suffering a great deal and constituents of yours who are suffering a great deal. I think what this bill does is it gives that small reassurance that immediately we can take care of you. And as the state, I think that's something that we can assist with and we should assist with. Also, you know, what we're working with the emergency fund is to deal with the immediacy of it. In the long term, if we do have a conviction on this case, then we can seek some of the reimbursement costs from the offender. But it deals with the immediate needs, and I think as a legislator, that's an obligation. That's something that we should cover for your constituents.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Ms. Notice. You noted in your testimony, as you example your story, $138 is some impound fee she paid. Well, last time my car got impounded, don't laugh, I paid, I think, $282. And that, of course, they had a cash machine. They only took cash up to Cedar Towing. And the cash machine only gave out $200 a pop and charged you $6 a pop to take it out. So you got to do it twice and pay their fee twice. Anyway, my question, other than making a public complaint, which I just did and feel better about that, about the cash machine, what is the average fee that people do pay? I mean, I'm guessing $138 is kind of low, isn't it?
Chairman, Representative Lesh, I used the $138 amount when I went on Hennepin County's website. That's the amount that they list as their impound fee, so I use that as my guide. There's going to be a variance among the different impound lots on what the towing fee is going to be, and it can, obviously, in your case, increase all the way up to $282.
Just one more question, Mr. Chair, and maybe I should know this, but is there any, I mean, can any impound lot charge whatever they want? And I know that when it's a government situation, it's probably regulated. A car gets impounded related to police action or something. But is there any other kind of regulation based on what they can charge?
Representative Damon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, I don't know, Ms. Prius, if you have any, you did the research on the bill. I don't believe that there's a standard amount. In St. Paul, the impound lot charges $163 plus fees on a daily basis. In Minneapolis, it's $138. I don't know if you have any more.
Ms. Prius.
Mr. Chair and members, I don't know if there's a cap. I do know that some of the cities have their own impound lots and others contract with private towing companies, and I don't know if I could defer to Representative Hillstrom.
Sure.
If she has any additional comments.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. my family has been in the towing business for many years, and so I don't vote on these kinds of issues. But no, there is not a cap on what they can charge. But if you do contracting for a police department or something, they do contracts. The cities require that they charge certain amounts for certain kinds of work. Mm-hmm. And so any of the cities or the state patrol, for example, you know, have an amount that the towing companies are allowed to charge.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, and this could go, first question is probably to staff. I just want to know if the Crime Victims Witness Advisory Council is an ongoing appropriation, and is this assumed $100,000 in addition to that, or is this the... Would that be the sum total of the appropriation that would probably be filled in on line 3.12 later on?
Ms. Pierce.
Mr. Chair and Representative Biskins, the emergency grant program is currently funded through OJP's reparation budget. I believe it's $150,000 a year. This $100,000, or estimated $100,000 that you would see in Section 6, the appropriation would be in addition to that. And this appropriation in Section 6 would only fund reimbursement of towing and storage fees.
Mr. Chairman, and then back to staff, I don't understand. I can't find in the language here what would prevent it from being utilized for any of the other five uses already listed on page one. Where is that barrier that says this new appropriation can only be used for the towing charge and can't be used for the replacement of necessary property, et cetera, that's listed on line one?
Ms. Pierce.
Mr. Chair, Representative Biggum, Representative Biskins. If you look at the language on line 3.14, I don't know if that helps clarify your answer or question.
It does. Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, to Chairman Paymar. Chairman Paymar, was there any thought given at all to, rather than create this new caveat, to just allow this to be another allowable use of the auto theft prevention program dollars? In other words, create one more allowable use and then change the name to auto theft prevention and victim reparations program. Any thought at all to doing that?
Representative Paymar.
Representative Biskins, that's exactly what I wanted to do.
Okay.
I think that there's a clear link there, but there was, because of the past history of this committee taking money from the Auto Theft Prevention Board, the insurance industry has been concerned that we've been siphoning off so much of the money. But that's what I wanted to do. In fact, the fiscal note even says that there's money in the account. Maybe when we mark up the omnibus bill, if the committee wants to amend that, I'd be happy to do it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any other questions? Any final comments?
No, Mr. Chair.
Anyone from the audience have anything they desire to say? If not, the chair will lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you.
Got its name.
Representative Hillstrom, House File 503. You want to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that House File 503 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Very good. Do you want to present your bill and your testifier?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be brief. This bill expands the scopes of the statute that criminalizes solicitation of children to engage in sexual conduct by adding it to the statute offenses committed over the Internet. And with me is the Attorney General's Office, who brought me the bill.
Mr. Boyce, do you want to introduce yourself for the record, please?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, representatives. My name is David Boyce.
I'm an assistant attorney general, and this bill is about protecting children in the internet age. With the internet, sexual predators have unprecedented access to children, and unfortunately, they have an unprecedented opportunity for anonymity in communicating with children. According to the Polyclas Foundation, about one half of teenagers communicate over the internet with people that they have not met. A very common pattern that investigators see when investigating communication between sexual predators and children is that the predators often do not come out immediately and solicit children for sex. Current Minnesota law does prohibit the explicit solicitation of children for sex, but what it does not prohibit is the grooming activity that investigators see so often, the sexual conversation, the dissemination of pornography from an adult to a child, and that is what this bill prohibits. Attorney General Lori Swanson urges passage of this bill because essentially it aims to stop sexual predators earlier in the process before they make an explicit solicitation for sex, which is where children are most vulnerable. Again, Attorney General Swanson urges passage of this bill, and I would be happy to answer any questions that you have if I can.
Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And your last name again, sir? I'm sorry.
Voigt. V as in Victor, O-I-G-T.
Mr. Voigt, Subdivision 2B, the jurisdiction provision, page 2, line 12 through 14. Can you just give me some assurance that we feel that there is that provision? I like the bill. I like what we're trying to do. I like the fact that we're even trying to reach to people outside of the jurisdiction of Minnesota. Is that provision constitutional? Have you looked at it? I guess I'm a little concerned about the ability of the state to reach out across our borders, and I want to have some assurance that if we pass this, it's going to hold up.
Mr. Boyd, the jurisdiction provision is similar to the jurisdiction provision in similar bills in a lot of other states, and in fact, it is similar to existing Minnesota law for general criminal offenses. In the beginning of Chapter 609, the general jurisdiction provision says that the state has jurisdiction if the crime either occurred in Minnesota or the effects of the crime were felt in Minnesota, and this jurisdiction provision is essentially duplicative of that.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Voigt, do you know if that's been tested in the courts and found to be constitutional? I hope it has. Again, I like what we're doing here. I just want to have some assurance that if we do it, it's not going to get thrown out.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, I'm not aware of any specific challenges as it relates to the internet, but in other contexts, it's been challenged and found to be constitutional.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Representative Fiskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and Mr. Voigt, I guess I feel a little smarmy having to argue this, all right, but I like the bill. I'll put that out there. I just, I have three daughters myself, and you talk about that people don't know who they're talking to, but that anonymity goes both ways. Does this bill protect an adult who has reason to believe that they are speaking to an adult?
Mr. Voigt.
Mr. Chair, Representative Biskins, the bill itself has an affirmative defense provision in Subdivision 3 so that if the communicator, the adult, has a reasonable good faith basis for believing that he or she is communicating with the child, that would be a defense to a prosecution under this bill.
Representative Biskin.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Voigt, and I see that that in Subdivision 3, but Subdivision 3 only points specifically to Subdivision 2A. What about Section 1, Subdivision 2? The first part there, does it also give that kind of protection under subdivision 2?
Mr. Boyd.
Mr. Chair, Representative Biskins, it does not, and this bill does not change existing law in that regard. We currently have the law that prohibits it prohibits solicitation of a child to engage in sex with a specific intent to follow through and engage in that sexual conduct, which is also a part of subdivision 2. And existing law specifically provides that mistake of age is not a defense to a prosecution in subdivision 2. And this bill doesn't change what's already in there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but Mr. Voigt, unless current law is written on stone tablets, I do believe it's probably possible that current law needs to be tweaked. I think we see that all the time, given the electronic age. My question to you is, should current law be tweaked? Should there be, because again, this is solicitation, we're talking about an internet age. If a person has reason to believe because the other party told them that they were communicating with a 25-year-old female, shouldn't that be included under the affirmative defense of prosecution?
Mr. Voigt, Mr. Chair, Representative Biskins, I believe the reason the current law didn't have that affirmative defense provision is because it assumed communication in a different way than over the internet, either face to face, perhaps telephone. The internet situation presumably would be prosecuted under subdivision 2A, and that's because for prosecutors, it's going to be easier. You're not going to have that critical element of proving that the offender has the specific intent of following through with the sexual conduct. So my suggestion would be to leave the affirmative defense only to internet communications, precisely because of the concerns that you identified, because it's over the internet, it's that internet communication that sometimes can prevent a barrier from knowing exactly who you're communicating with.
Are there any other questions? Representative Dominguez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Voigt, could you possibly tell us how often are we experiencing such activity going on? And has this gone national?
Mr. Voigt.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can't give you statistics, but I can tell you that investigators for the Internet Crimes Against Computers Task Force say that when they get on the internet posing as a child and they go to chat rooms, they estimate that it takes 5 to 10 minutes maximum before they start receiving communication of a sexual nature, and that's after they have identified themselves as a teenager. So it's a significant problem. It does seem to occur very often, and I believe it's a national problem, probably also an international problem.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually went to ICAC, and they set up a fake biography of a person, and within 5 minutes we had been solicited. While I watched, it was very disturbing to me and amazing how rapidly that happened. But one of the things that makes the internet even more dangerous is that when you're doing something in person or over the phone, you can't completely change your identity because your voice sounds the same or you look the same. But on the internet, you're able to create a new profile and target the very same victim over and over and over again if you make a mistake. And so that is one of the reasons why it's, you know, even more important that we pass this bill.
Any other discussion? All right, then we'll lay over House File 503 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Mr. Voigt, thank you for your testimony. Representative Hellstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, is there a fiscal vote on this one?
Yes, there is. Representative Coles, and I, Mr. Carter is going to submit it for additional review because there was an amendment put on in the policy committee.
It was in the right order in my packet. I found it now. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hillstrom, you have the next bill up, 1464.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I would move that House File 1464 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the increase in 911 emergency telecommunications service fee and the armor provision expanded 911. And so with me is Mr. Whitehead to testify. This is the governor's proposal.
That's correct.
Mr. Whitehead, do you want to provide some brief testimony?
Certainly. My name is Ron Whitehead. I'm the Armor 911 Program Director in the Department of Public Safety. This committee graciously allowed us a considerable amount of time in a previous meeting to review this in detail, so I'm going to keep my comments short. But this is the governor's recommendation to complete the armor system. It's a project that began in 1995. The legislature adopted a plan to completely build the system in 2001 that was stalled for about 4 years, and finally was funded in 2005 when we funded Phase 3, which is in the process of being implemented at this point in time. The governor's recommendation is that we immediately begin the detailed design work and planning of the armor system such that we can start implementing Phases 4, 5, and 6, in fact eliminate the phases, and begin complete the implementation of that system in the remaining 55 counties of the state. So it'll be completed by 2012, when in fact there are some other deadlines by the FCC when people have to transition their communication system. It also provides for the full funding of the operating system backbone. So in essence, the governor's recommendation answers two big questions that we've had continually as we've talked about the need to transition communications. That is, will it be available to us and what will it cost to operate on it? In doing so, we'll provide the highest level of interoperability for public safety as we move across the state. The proposal also provides for $5.4 million to upgrade the system in the metropolitan area, and in a large part, that's the result of delaying the process of implementing over a 4 to 5 year period. We need to bring the metropolitan area up to a common platform. That also provides an opportunity for some competitiveness with the platform as we move ahead, as the current system is a single vendor, but as we move to the next platform, provides the opportunity for some competitiveness because they have adopted a inter-system standard that can possibly allow for different systems to interoperate. Also provides funding for the detailed design work, moving from conceptual plan to the detailed design work, and allows some funding for MnDOT to begin identifying sites and do the preliminary work that's necessary, some of the environmental work, site selection, and so forth, during this year period while we're doing the detailed design work. Recommendation provides for the funding of the operating costs, and that's actually a transfer to MnDOT, who are the owner and operator of the system. And the way it's funded, Mr. Chair, is that it's funded through an increase in the 911 fee, and that would occur in fiscal year 2009, 10 cents, fiscal year 2010, 10 cents, fiscal year 2011, 10 cents, for a net increase of 30 cents on the 911 fee, which is presently 65 cents per line. And also provides for the Department of Finance to sell revenue bonds based upon the increase in the 911 fee to fund the debt service on that.
Are there any questions, Mr. Whitehead? Representative Fiskin.
Thank
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I thought the testimony would go a little longer, so I got out the old blue book to look at what was being repealed, but seeing as testimony's done, I'll save myself some work and ask the author of the bill if she can tell the committee what is being repealed here. Mr. Chair, Representative Biskins, the only thing that's being repealed is, and I believe it's Chapter 40330, where Subdivision 6, 31, Subdivision 6 is being repealed. In the previous law, there was a distinction between the allocation of costs between Phase 1 and 2, which is primarily the metro area, and then Phase 3, 4, 5, and 6. And we merged those provisions into Phase 1 so everybody's treated equally, and then repealed Phase 6 that dealt exclusively with Phases 3, 4, 5, and 6. There was no change in large part in that language, other than we added the portion that accommodated the fact that we're undertaking to pay the operating costs. So the changes in the language are actually just accommodating the fact we're paying the operating costs. If, in fact, there were additional costs, there's a mechanism consistent with the current law of allocating that amongst the users and eliminating the distinction between the metro area and the outstate. They're merging those all into one provision.
Okay. Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for that explanation. That is thorough. To Representative Hillstrom, did the governor impose a tax increase on telephones rather than make tough spending decisions, in your opinion?
Representative Hillstrom, do you want to answer that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Typically, the Public Safety Committee doesn't get partisan. We try to work on public safety.
But Mr. Chairman, I take offense to that. I think this is an honest question. It's not meant to be partisan. In fact, I believe I'm the same party as the governor.
Okay. Restate your question, Representative Biskins. What is your question?
Yeah, I did. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, is it your opinion that the governor imposed the tax increase rather than look for making spending choices in other areas?
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Given the fact that in last year's omnibus bill, they defined a fee increase as a tax increase as well, I would say any fee or tax increase is a tax increase. So, yes, I would say this is a tax increase.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Cole.
Mr. Chair, I guess that begs the question, does this bill need to go to the Tax Committee? I believe the Tax Committee has jurisdiction over bills that purport to raise a tax. I had asked research to try to find that provision that Representative Hillstrom referred to, because I know that happened last year. Senator Pogamiller and Representative Krenke agreed to that in conference committee, and so I'm just trying to figure out, does the bill need to go there, or are we just going to lay it over? How are we going to handle that?
Mr. Carter, do you shed some light on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, we are researching this, and we will have an answer, I take it, by the end of the day.
Okay.
Hopefully, or maybe even by the end of the meeting.
Today. Mr. Chair, we're laying this over, correct? So if we do determine that what has been proposed here is a tax increase, we would have an opportunity to move it then to Representative Lincheski's committee. I'm sure she can't wait to see it.
If then, Paul, we could take that up as early as tomorrow and re-refer it.
Thank you.
Representative Cornish.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, whatever we end up calling this, I just want to make it clear that it has my unqualified support and urge its passage. And we've been messing around with this subject long enough, and it's about time we get it done. And every committee likes to have something they can say they really hung their hat on, got done, and I think this would be a good one for us. So, thank you.
Representative Bigham and then Murphy.
Mr. Chair, maybe advice from a freshman. I'm wondering if this is coming out of, would be kind of under your purview, wouldn't it stay here versus having to go to Chair Lincheski's committee? And I would second Representative Cornish's comments that this has my support too, but I'm just saying that maybe I'm a little confused. But
Representative Bigham, it would go to the Tax Committee and it would be referred back to our committee, as I understand it. It would come back.
Yeah.
The Tax Committee has has the authority and the obligation to review all tax matters.
So we'll go to the tax committee over the confusion of the definition of a tax or a fee.
That's correct.
Thanks.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, historical reference. When we started this, I was chair of the committee, and it didn't go to taxes. In all the years that Representative Smith was chair, it didn't go to taxes. We started it a long time ago, as Representative Cornish says. But I do disagree with one statement that it's time to get it done, I agree with. But I bet this isn't going to do it, to get it done. And I won't go into my rant because you've all heard it once this year already. I don't see a need that it has to go to taxes because custom and usage, historical reference, we haven't done it.
Representative Murphy, we'll let Mr. Kreger sort this out, and if it doesn't have to go to taxes, it will it won't go to taxes. Representative Olin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick comment, no questions. Speaking from Greater Minnesota, this 911 project needs to be completed. The funding needs to be figured out right, and I fully urge everyone to support this whole process because this needs to get done.
Any other discussion? Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Whitehead. Representative Hillstrom, we will lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, and we'll form the committee on Tuesday.
We don't vote.
Thursday. What, Mr. Progress? Come on.
We don't vote.
Not to lay it over. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Final bill on the calendar. Oh, wait, we have Representative Kosh, is he?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Privilege of the committee, please.
Go ahead.
If we did vote today on laying this over for possible inclusion, I would be a no. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. The chair will move House File 787 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Hosh, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members. It's good to be here today. House File 787 deals with an issue that I'm sure you're all very familiar with, and that's with the build-out of the 800 megahertz interoperable system, and also the challenges that it faces, that it presents to our local communities. In Stearns County, where I come from, I think we have a unique situation, and I'm not going to expound on it too much since my testifiers are much more engaged and informed on the issue. But in Stearns County, we have a mix of demographics and populations within the county. We have an urban center with St. Cloud and then some very rural areas, and it's really been creating some challenges. The cost associated, not just with the build-out, but with the equipment necessary to take advantage of the system, is very expensive. And when we're faced with decreasing LGA amounts, increased property taxes, increased needs for infrastructure, my bill proposes to try to establish a grant program for the purchase of equipment for the 800 megahertz radio system. This would be a competitive grant in which different local units of government can apply for this. And those in most need hopefully will be directed with the most help. As a former mayor of St. Joseph, I have a little bit of experience with this. Our fire department was given radios, and the chief of St. Joseph is here now because he's mad at me because the police department didn't get any. And that's because of some lack of funds and just the way that some federal grants have worked out. But with that said, I don't want to talk too much longer as we have the Stearns County Sheriff and the St. Joseph Chief here that can answer questions and also explain the situation in much better clarity than I.
Okay. Who's going to start?
I can.
Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for the opportunity. My name is John Sanner. I'm the Stearns County Sheriff, and my testimony is on behalf of the Minnesota State Sheriff's Association. As this committee has probably already heard, a stream of testimony from public safety professionals ranging from police, fire, and EMS personnel into the benefit of a truly interoperable statewide radio system. The people that are testifying are the people that are first-hand responders to these disasters and understand firsthand that the first thing that breaks down is communications. I personally think that this interoperable statewide communication system that we're trying to put into place is the most significant advancement in public safety in my law enforcement career. Now, this has been completed for the most part in the metropolitan area. And both Stearns County and Olmsted County have been targeted as outstate buildouts. And Stearns County is in the process of doing that right now. But what happens is you move outstate in Minnesota, the communities get smaller and the communities have less money. And when you ask these communities to purchase expensive radio equipment, I'm talking the radios to communicate with, that becomes a huge expense for them. We're talking about volunteer firefighters that in order to buy equipment, they have to have fundraisers like breakfasts and things like that to raise money. So it's a very significant cost for those individuals, and we're struggling with that in Stearns County right now. It's like we've purchased a brand new car and somebody has pulled four of the spark plug wires off of it. It's not running the way it should be running. We need to get these radios in the hands of all of these first responders so it can truly be an interoperable radio system. Local government can only do so much. Stearns County has stepped up to the plate and is assisting the local governments in helping purchase the radios, but we can only do so much. The state of Minnesota truly has to assume a leadership role in this radio project. We need the state's help. We're asking for the state's help, and I know you understand the importance here. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheriff.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Pete Jansky, and I'm Chief of Police in the City of St. Joseph. I'm also here to represent the Minnesota Police Chiefs Association, of which I'm the president. First, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank you, the legislators, for taking a very proactive approach this session regarding interoperable radio communication. The men and women in public safety are looking forward to being able to work side by side in being able to communicate with each other. I know that that sounds very hard to believe, but in the area that I currently work in now, since we've switched over and some of us are limited on 800, we are finally now able to talk to the City of St. Cloud, some of our neighboring communities, and soon hopefully to be able to talk to the State Patrol. This area has been long overlooked, and I applaud the governor and the legislature for making this a priority item this legislative session. The next problem we're having is getting our portable and mobile radios in the hands of the public safety people. A number of communities had to rely on radios that are 10 and 15 years old. Because of budget constraints, they have not been able to purchase upgraded equipment needed in these areas. With interoperability, of course, our old radios are no longer going to work, and new equipment comes at a very costly price tag. An example of this is for the City of St. Joseph. Currently, the police department was lucky enough to share in one of the first Homeland Security grants that came in. The St. Cloud metropolitan area went together, includes five cities, and we were able to get one of the first Homeland Security grants that came out for this. The City of St. Joseph or the police department received $36,000 to purchase 10 800 megahertz portable radios. As you know, Homeland Security money is pretty much non-existent, and we now have to rely on tax dollars to fund any future equipment. Just to finish this project in the City of St. Joseph, and as Representative Harsh stated, our fire department was fortunate enough to get a FEMA grant to purchase their radios, which I believe was in the tune of roughly $45,000. Just to finish the 800 build-out in our community will cost us roughly $64,000, hopefully in the next 2 years. In the City of Albany, which is a smaller community just west of me, yeah, I spoke with their fire chief, and they took their FEMA grant, and instead of purchasing the radio equipment that they needed, they felt that their personal protection clothing, their bunker pants and jackets, were outdated and needed to be updated, so that's what they used their money for. In speaking to the fire chief, they will need just $42,000 to outfit the necessary radio equipment that they'll need for their fire department. This still does not include what it's going to cost for the build-out for the police and maintenance department. A number of our police, fire, and ambulance services around Stearns County and around our state are pretty much in the same boat. Most cities, especially the small ones, just don't have the money available for purchasing this equipment.
This defeats the purpose of the bail route and prolongs the problem. I'd like to ask you to keep this in mind when you consider Representative Hosh's bill. In my 29 years of law enforcement, I find radio interoperability to be the single most important issue at this time. We still have everyone, you know, we just need to get everyone on the same page to be able to communicate with each other. This keeps our public safety people to do a better job in delivering services to the people we serve. Thank you.
Representative Plunish.
Mr. Chair, maybe council can help or Mr. Whitehead, but I would like to know how many different departments. We're not talking just law enforcement. We're talking about, I think, public safety, right? So it would be EMS and fire and cops all together. How many different agencies would be eligible to seek this grant statewide, and what kind of a fiscal note would that be if just round figure?
That's a question for you, Mr. Carter. Or is that a possibility?
You know, Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, we put an informal or a formal fiscal note request on this, and Mr. Whitehead said or informed me today that it's going to finance for the final sign out, so he should have some more information on it.
Mr. Whitehead?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, yes, we did do a fiscal note on this. There are a couple of things I would like to point out. The first is that remind the committee that we are confronted with replacing these portables and mobiles no matter what. Even if the armor system wasn't built out, everybody's confronted with replacing portables and mobiles. And so this is a cost that's naturally to be expected, even for those that may remain with their VHF systems and so forth. We, as part of the fiscal note, we tried to make an estimate as to how many radios that would be. The bill itself does not limit it to public safety only. And in fact, the system is one that is a governmental system. What we did do is we tried to rely on Stearns County and Olmsted County experience and make an estimate if you applied that on a population base. And essentially came out with if you're paying the full cost of portables and mobiles, that it would be a fiscal note of about $9 million each year of the biennium for both phase one, which is there's still about 3,000 radios to be acquired probably in the metropolitan area, and then the count in the phase three area beyond Olmsted and Stearns County used a figure of about 4,500 portable radios and figured about two-thirds of those were public safety radios, and then one-third were public works and less demanding type radios. And that's where we came up with that figure. Now, that's full reimbursement. In the past, we have used Homeland Security money to buy some portables in 2003 and 2004. Our experience had been at that point we used the money to pay about 50% of the cost. I will add one additional thing is that the federal government is finally doing some allocation of funding that would be available to local communities to fund that. There is, in fact, $1 billion. Now, that's $1 billion for the nation, not for the state of Minnesota. I wish it was. But that will be available for 700, 800 equipment, and is supposed to be allocated as of the end of this year. And that's money in the bank. That was actually passed with the 2006 Budget Reconciliation Act, and then Congress came along and said, get that money distributed, and the MOU between Department of Commerce and the Department of Homeland Security has actually been signed that will allocate that funding for portables and mobiles and local infrastructure improvements. So there will be some money coming along to help fund some of those costs.
Senator Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Cornish. My intention of this bill also is to direct resources to the most needed areas. And I would be happy to work with anybody from this committee to get your expertise and your advice on how we can make this a better bill. I know that unrealistic that we don't have enough money to give 100% grant to all of our communities that need a radio system. And that's not my intention. I'm not getting in trouble with my testifiers here today. But we need to work in conjunction with our local communities, with our EMS, with our public safety departments, with our fire departments, and find a way in which we can work in cooperation to ensure that this equipment is purchased and, you know, take advantage of the interoperable radio system. And as I'm going along, I'm willing to listen to any suggestions on how to make this better or direct it towards the greatest need.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I should look closer at the previous bill, but in the one with the increase in the surcharge, that money would be just used for infrastructure, right? And the mainframe, we wouldn't, so these would be two separate. That was my fear, that some of the first monies would be drained off instead of building a system and buying all the mobiles and portables. Thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, question, Mr. Whitehead. How much does a penny raise on the 911 fee?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, one penny raises approximately $700,000 a year.
Representative Murphy.
And Chief Jansky and Sheriff Hanna, during the years before this came, did your predecessors approach the armor people? I wasn't called that from the beginning, I don't think, but the people that were putting the system together before it got to your phase, and try to get a cut of the money?
Mr. Chair, if you want
to. Mr. Chair, Representative, not that I'm aware of. This system is relatively new, and I've been the sheriff for the past 5 years. And I'm not aware that the previous sheriff made any request for additional funding from the state of Minnesota to put in an 800 megahertz or interoperable radio system, because the technology was simply too new at that particular time.
But, and Mr. Chair, I would just like to say that if my memory serves me, it was the idea that the state was going to do the backbone, and the local communities and regions were going to do what was necessary to hook into the backbone.
Representative Haas.
I was serving at the time these things were put in, and it was quite aware to us that the backbone is the backbone, but the affordability of these two of the small communities was an obvious problem and pointed out at that time. And we still went out on the limb and said, let's do this, let's get the backbone in, but we're going to need help, and the EMS and those small communities are going to need help, or the backbone is about the silliest creature you've ever had until you actually have the radios out here working. This has to be done in order to get the backbone and your investment to function. And I'm afraid that these communities will start misspending money on old radios and on poorer investments if they're not given some help.
Representative Biscuit.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, to the two officers, I do believe that this is an allowable use of charitable gaming dollars. Have you made any attempt to go to your organizations, your community organizations that have charitable gaming, and ask for contributions for purchase of these?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we have tapped our local organizations to the point where charitable gambling dollars just aren't there anymore. Everyone is going to them for pretty much the needs that they have, and believe it or not, in our community, charitable gambling dollars has dried up considerably from what it used to be.
Do you have any closing comments, Representative Howell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
It's only 10.
Go ahead. Excuse me, I didn't hear you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you to the committee. I appreciate your time on this. As we consider the build-out of the 800 megahertz radio system, we have to realize what our actions also do to our local units of government and our smaller communities. It's a great goal. It's a great system. It's something that we have to do, and I think most people in the state do not understand that our local law enforcement and public safety organizations can't communicate with each other without the system. But as we move forward, I hope we can move forward judiciously and make sure that we don't make local governments overly rely on us, but that we can work in cooperation with local units of government and make sure that the purchase of this equipment to take advantage of our infrastructure in the 800 megahertz system can be achieved in partnership. And I appreciate the committee's time. As we move forward, if you have suggestions on how to make this grant system better, how to make it more accountable, and how to direct those funds towards those that need the money the most, please let me know as I look at this as a work in progress, and I want to make sure that we can do whatever we can to be successful.
We have one final question or comment. Representative Murphy.
Well, I've listened very carefully, and Representative Haas spoke very wisely. And Mr. Whitehead, when you were talking about going up to 30 cents, up to 95 cents, did you talk at all about going up to a dollar and having a nickel in a fund that local communities could apply for grants from?
Mr. Whitehead.
Chair Representative Murphy, we do fully anticipate that the 30 cents will in fact provide some funding for infrastructure, because the pattern has been established to pay up to 50% of the infrastructure cost. We had not anticipated putting portables and mobiles into that. As I said, there are grant opportunities coming down from the federal government, and it would be our hope that those grants will provide the opportunity for portables and mobiles for people, but we did not include portables and mobiles in that that discussion, because the pattern has been essentially that we build the backbone and that we provide up to 50% of the funding for local infrastructures.
Any further discussion? Mr. Whitehead, Sheriff Sanner, and Chief Jansky, thank you for your testimony. Thank you, Representative Posh. We will lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
We have one more item of business, members. Unless there's an objection, House File 693, Representative Lesh is not here. I'm not sure where he, but this was the bill on the driver's license reinstatement fee and the surcharge and installment payments that we heard yesterday. This bill, after consultation with Mr. Carter, has to go to transportation finance. So unless there's an objection, I would like to move that House File 693, as amended, be recommended to be referred to the Finance Committee with a recommendation that they re-refer it to transportation finance. Representative Biskins.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Will it eventually come back to this committee?
Representative Biskins, as I understand, no.
All right. Then, Mr. Chair, absent a legitimate fiscal note, I'm going to have to vote no.
Is there any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion prevails. If there's no other business before the committee, this meeting's adjourned.